It's Reefer Madness, the podcast with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, we're back.
Hey, Trevor, how's it going?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm all right. I went out to a restaurant for the first time in many, many months. It was very odd.
That's what you're saying. So yeah. I'm not sure I've been in a restaurant. Physically in a restaurant. I picked up stuff up from a restaurant, but yeah. Sat down in one. I don't know. It might be a year. It's been a while anyway.
Well, it was odd. Now I guess I should qualify this. Last week I was in Steinbeck. I was taking Van Hoot for a ride. Michelle and I bought an old van that we planned to travel Western Canada in as soon as things open up. But we did a trip in southern Manitoba, and we did sit in a restaurant and had lunch. But I guess lunch isn't like having dinner. You know, going out for dinner and you have to wait in line, and I got asked for my address. Michelle and I had to show that we lived in the same house. I had to show my double vaccines. Then we had to figure out who was with us and were they from the same house? Did they have vaccines? Then we had to give I did everything but give my firstborn over. So it was odd. And then we sit in a restaurant and you look around and it's very sparse. But we got to eat in a restaurant.
Very good. You beat me. I would like to do that soon, but it hasn't quite come up.
So you have brought another paper that's adding to our opiate and cannabis trilogy. Or we've got like three or four episodes focused on opiates helping cannabis helping with opiates.
Yeah. So sort of off the top of my head, we had Dr. Peter Grinspoon. He was a physician who admitted had some of his own opioid addictions in the past, and now, with caveats, uses cannabis to help reduce opioids in some patients. We've had a self-described junkie talking about how he uses cannabis to help with his opioid addictions. So this is
then we had Tilray's study.
Yes.
Right.
Sorry, I forgot about Dr. Lucas and the Tilray study.
Well, I was going to say that's episode 69 and episode 66 and episode 70. Those are all episodes that are related to this episode.
And the Tilray was put some more numbers behind it when they weren't. They just sort of looked at what happened in their clinics, and lo and behold, when people use cannabis, they use less opioids. So I'm not saying it was all leading to this one, but this was, I think, a nice tying things together that this is now a bunch of experts who have gotten together to say, hey, if you have somebody on opioids, can you get them off or reduce the opioids with cannabis? And if you're going to do that, Who should it be? How do you do it? And how do you monitor them afterwards?
Yeah, I got into this paper and read it yesterday. I find the technique of the Delphi technique of qualitative research interesting, because essentially it's crowdsourcing, right? They have crowdsourced a handful of experts, and the paper lists the experts and their affiliations, and they ask them questions about how they're using cannabis. Now I'm looking at they call it a five point question study. So they did, and you get into the talk. They talk about screening their patients, the initiation of how they initiate cannabis, how they titrate the cannabis, how they taper people off opioids while they're on cannabis, and then how they follow up. And at Delphi, do you want to explain a Delphi technique of qualitative research?
Well, first I'm going to go into, this episode was a lot of fun, but this is my episode of humility, or my anti-hubris, or the don't think too much of yourself, Trevor. So to back up, when I was trying to organize this, so I literally had people coast to coast to coast. I had West Coast, East Coast, Ontario, us. And so, we got time zone issues. So Dr. Colleen O'Connell, who you'll hear from, said, well, why don't you just send out a doodle poll? Now, for those of you who don't know, it's an app you can send out to let people sort of pick times. Now, I have received many doodle poll requests for meetings in the past and, you know, selected my time. It all worked. I've never organized a meeting with a doodle poll before, and apparently I am a doodle poll idiot and kept sending them time requests for the middle of the night because I kept saying that my time zone was somewhere in Europe. So after, you know, getting a bunch of confused emails from esteemed people across Canada, I finally admitted I wasn't so good at the doodle poll, but we finally got it organized. And then, during the interview, you'll hear Dr. O'Connell again school me just a little bit on Delphi. Maybe I was making light of it a little bit by saying, you know, basically, is this glorified anecdotes? And the answer is no, it is not.
Well, this is how experts get their opinions quantified, right? This is you made a comment with Dr. Pinnock about the first time this, first time that. You know, the first time a doctor delivers a baby, the first time a doctor gives cannabis. Well, this is a study, consensus-based recommendations for titrating cannabis and tapering opioids for chronic pain control, asking questions of experts. So these are people who are considered cannabis prescribing experts who have been asked specific questions that relate to literature. So this is actually a modified Delphi technique that they've done. And they ask a series of questions. And as I said, they had their categories. They had their categories of screening the client, the initiation of the cannabis, the titration of the cannabis, the tapering of the opioids, and the follow-up processes. Those experts would have been asked a series of questions relating it to the literature, and then the answers create more questions, and the facilitators of the research then pose more questions from the answers, until they get to a consensus of opinion. So this is how practitioners first learn to come together to create their craft. So this is a fascinating way of doing research, and as I said, it's a modified technique. Now I'm going to ask you: did you notice that the series of professionals involved with this research, two of them have been guests of our podcast?
I did. So yeah, obviously this, you know, we're picking some good people. So other than the people who are talking today, other people on the list who we have talked to before include Paul Danick, oncologist and palliative care guru from about two episodes ago. And way back from Kids and Cannabis, we have Dr. Seeley. Either we or they have a really good group of people. So I quite like the fact we had and they mentioned a few times, and we'll let them talk shortly. This group of almost 20 people they have on here we have clinicians, we have like scientists, like bench researchers, we have different professions, like Aaron Saholta, who will be on there as a pharmacist, and Colleen O'Connell as a physician. So there's It's a big range of people too. So it's nice to see they got a lot of, yeah. And Dr. Brendan Smith will mention it, but yes, they wish and hope there will be more. He keeps calling them RCTs. So in case you missed that, RCT is randomized controlled trial. But until we get more of them, this is a great way to sort of try to figure out what's going on by really rigorously asking these questions of experts and seeing where they agree.
Yeah, now, just before I get started, I'm just going to a quick review of the abstract of the study. I'm reading the study from the International Journal of Clinical Practice, and their aims was, it goes back to opioids misuse, and overuse has contributed to a widespread overdose crisis, and many patients and physicians are considering medical cannabis to support opioid tapering and chronic pain control. So they use a five-step modified Delphi process, and their aim is to develop a consensus-based recommendation on three components: when and how to safely initiate and titrate cannabinoids in the presence of opioids. Number two, when and how to safely taper opioids in the presence of cannabinoids. And number three, how to monitor patients and to evaluate outcomes when treating with opioids and cannabinoids. Now, I'll save the results because they get into the results. But I guess at the end, we can talk about that as well. So, yeah, I found, once again, Trevor, I compliment you. I think this is a wonderful contribution to the three episodes focused on opioids and cannabis. This makes a nice fourth.
Yeah, no, I agree. And rather than just hear us wag our lips around about this, why don't we let the experts talk about what the experts talked about?
Done.
Yeah, pleased to be on the podcast. My name is Aaron Sahota. I'm out here on the West Coast in Vancouver. I'm a primary care pharmacist, and I work in a multidisciplinary medical cannabis clinic where we assess and evaluate patients for various medical conditions. And one of the co-authors of the consensus guidelines we'll talk about today.
Fantastic. How about Brandon?
Yeah, thanks, Trevor. And thanks for having me on. This is great. I work for a medical communications company. I'm the medical lead there. Do quite a bit of work in project management, medical writing, facilitating different types of methodologies. And so, this modified Delphi process that we leveraged for this project was a really interesting way to get at, I suppose, a difficult scientific question.
Thank you. And Colleen on the East Coast.
Hi, so I'm Colleen O'Connell. I'm a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I work predominantly in neuro rehabilitation. So I work with individuals who have fairly complex diagnoses that impact on their mobility, as well as can contribute to symptoms such as pain and spasticity. And I've been involved in working with patients in trying to achieve health goals, and have been using medical cannabis and cannabinoid products now for over 20 years with my patients, and certainly really enjoyed working with this large transdisciplinary team in putting together this consensus guidance.
Thank you very much. So just for I'll say that I read it once properly. So the official title is Consensus-Based Recommendations for Titrating Cannabinoids and Tapering Opioids for Chronic Pain Control. Before I ask, there's sort of three main things. I think I'm going to start with Brendan because it comes up a couple times. And honestly, I didn't know before reading this. What is this Delphi process that you guys use to come to these? It may be a shortened version because it sounds like it's relatively involved.
We set it up. I mean, here's the thing. Everyone would love randomized control trials. That's the gold standard. That's what we want. But currently, we do not have them for tapering opioids in the presence of cannabinoids. So the medical cannabis, the use of cannabis to taper opioids in the presence of chronic pain, is an interesting space because it's one of the very few spots, I think, where you have patients doing it themselves, mm-hmm. or going to a physician or a pharmacist and asking them for their advice. So it's this clinical unmet need. And it's unusual. Usually you have an RCT to provide some guidance. And if you don't, then patients aren't going in and asking for it. But in this situation, they are. And so in a situation like this, a modified Delphi process is a way to add scientific robustness to expert opinion. Okay. So we'd like to have RCTs. We don't. What's the next best thing? We have people like Dr. O'Connell and Aaron Sahota on the line who manage patients that do this. They've done it for 20 years. And so we leverage their expert opinion in addition to having others on the line as well to add scientific robustness to expert opinion.
Okay. And so I guess this gets around I was listening to a podcast with different researchers on a different topic. And, you know, these were bench researchers and they said the worst thing in the world is to have a physician say, in my experience, because then they just go off into anecdotes. So this is a way to get, for example, Dr. O'Connell's 20 years of experience more, I don't know, not to just be a bunch of anecdotes.
It, Trevor, the Delphi process is an actual recognized method for providing direction and recommendations in healthcare. It's not a new process. It was actually kind of invented during the Cold War to garner consensus amongst a large number of experts in order to provide information. And in this case, in the Cold War, was to forecast the impact of technology on warfare. And it's a well-recognized way in healthcare, and it's reliable, to derive consensus for a certain clinical problem using an iterative, systematic process, repeated rounds of voting, using a large group of experts. And it's in place of areas where you are lacking definitive expert. And best practice is well recognized in what we do. Clinical experience and expertise makes up a part of best practice in addition to published literature.
No, and thank you. I think that explains it really well. And I won't bore the listeners with the exactly how all the voting was done, but maybe Aaron or Brennan, there was a lot of people involved in all this voting. Can you give me an idea about how many bodies were involved in getting these consensus?
You know, I can kind of just chime in here and mention that the strength of this paper, the strength of this particular guidance document is, as you mentioned, Trevor, is the large group, but the multidisciplinary nature of who we have. We have frontline clinicians with real world experience helping the patients. We have researchers as well who studied cannabinoid science, not only from Canada, but we had a few people from the US as well. And I believe, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we had 16, if I'm not mistaken, around 16 people come together from Canada and the US to look at sort of the best way of building sort of an easy to follow algorithm that frontline clinicians everywhere could use as a guidance document from the lens of a safety perspective.
Okay, I'm convinced. So I'll throw this open to anybody. So that there's three main questions that the consensus guidelines were looking at. Who wants to tackle what your sort of three main questions were?
Sure, I can start, Trevor. Our first question was identifying what patient would be someone that we would consider for introducing cannabinoids. And very specifically, this paper was looking at not the broad range of individuals who might be wanting to access and use cannabis because of chronic pain, but this was very specific initiative towards people who are already using opioids. Okay. So one of the impetuses for this and why we started with this paper, even before just a general algorithm for cannabis in general in pain, was because of the opioid crisis. And that was really one of the sounding bells that said, you know, here in North America, the number of deaths and hospitalization due to opioid overdoses and misuses, whether they're prescription or not, was really quite alarming. And with emerging reports that individuals were replacing opioids with cannabis, we really felt it important that we provide physicians in advance of having large randomized controlled trials, which may never happen in this field, with a guidance. So the first is, what patients are we looking at? And so we reach consensus that essentially any patient with chronic pain who is on opioids would be appropriate for considering cannabinoids if they're not reaching their goals. So any patient who's being treated with pain has certain goals. They want to reduce their pain. They want to be more functional. They want to get back to work. They want to do something with their kids. So despite adequate treatment with their opioids and physiotherapy, the modalities, psychology supports, everything else being optimized, they're still not reaching their goals, that might be an appropriate patient. Additionally, a patient who might be on opioids and is experiencing adverse effects from those opioids. And we could talk about all the various side effects and adverse effects of opioids. And then the third group are those which were concerned about opioid-related harm. So those who might be at risk because of how they're using the opioids. And as a health professional, we feel they would be safer health-wise by getting them off of or reducing their opioids. So that was our first question. Who are we looking at?
Excellent. So who wants to tackle number two? So you've identified them now. Now, what was the second question for the group?
Yeah, I think when you're looking at sort of when and how to safely taper opiates in the presence of cannabinoids. So keeping in mind, just going back to a little bit of what Colleen mentioned, as we conceptualize this project, and I remember as initially speaking with Dr. MJ Malloy, who is a professor of cannabis science research chair here at ABC, and I'm clinical faculty at the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences as well, is understanding that we found that clinicians were already doing this to some extent in their respective practices. It's about kind of bringing it together and harmonizing sort of strategy of how to identify at what point a patient would fall into this algorithm. And how to safely taper the opiates in the presence of cannabinoids, because we know we can't, a lot of patients that we're dealing with are on opiates for a long time. You know, we're not talking about patients who've for a couple of weeks here, per se. We're talking about someone who's maybe experienced chronic pain issues, major trauma, accident, and they're looking for other alternatives. And also at the same time, we're looking at sort of, you know, at what stepwise approach, how many milligrams of either CBD or THC can safely be titrated? And at what point do we measure, how do we assess levels of pain? At what point the clinician can look at having the discussion around tapering, terping the opiate? So I think that we looked at sort of putting all those elements and pieces together and coming up with guidance that looked at a specific sort of, I guess you can call it, range of how many milligrams to increase or decrease by, and how to safely monitor the conversation as well.
Thank you very much. And the third one was, how are you going to maintain outcomes? I assume that's more about follow-up afterwards. Is that sort of the third question?
The third question is, and so Aaron kind of talked about our second and third question together, which is the actual doses to initiate somebody on the cannabinoid, and then how to titrate that dose, and then to start bringing down the opioid. And then our third one is exactly as you were just saying, which is how do we monitor and how do we decide how often to see the patient, how to keep track of whether they're having good benefits, side effects, when do we consider things a treatment success, and when would we consider things a treatment failure?
Thank you. That was excellent. So now we've got what Delphi is and what sort of the questions we were looking at. So I guess the big reveal. So what consensus did you guys come to? What sort of patients are we looking at? How do we decrease the dosing, and how do we follow up? Who wants to start?
I can chime in here. So I think first is kind of looking at sort of what type of patients could be considered, and how do you screen for patients for the introduction of cannabinoids as part of their treatment plan. I think we looked at obviously a few different health populations, and one of them being patients who are not reaching their chronic pain goals despite psychological and physical interventions. We know that those are key pillars as part of our overall treatment strategy and the modalities that we provide for patient care when it comes to pain management, as well as those experiencing opiate-related adverse effects. So, everything from, CNS depressant effects, drowsiness, constipation, dry mouth. There's a lot of side effects that patients often we see in the front lines complain about that impact their quality of life. And that certainly is one sort of, one sort of hint for a clinician to consider as a patient who might fit well in an algorithm like this. And then finally, looking at sort of patients displaying risk factors for opiate-related harm and or abuse potential. And this is often a discussion, with the clinician and the patient, and other comorbidities a patient may be displaying as well, is if they're a higher risk. Obviously, we know the potential for addiction with cannabinoids is on the same par as when you look at alcohol or cannabis use disorder. Comparing that to the risk of being on opiates is less. So we're looking at sort of those patient populations, and then moving on to, as part of that screening process, is are we looking at initiating cannabinoids in the daytime or the evening? And then we move on to the initiation process, which I'm happy to pass along to one of my my colleagues.
Sure. Who wants to take on initiation?
If I can just add a little bit of color to the daytime versus evening, and because my role was kind of in the back end and managing like a lot of the voting responses, and there was a lot of different conversations that went into, hey, we should be considering cannabinoids first off, not just as cannabis, but we need to split it out as CBD and THC as it go, but we also need to split it out by daytime and evening, especially when you're initiating. These are all separate conversations. So the delineation of that algorithm took place over months of time, and to end up at a daytime recommendation of CBD, again, safety, tolerability, were the two main factors that went into it. And then also there is limited evidence for opioid tapering with CBD, but it is there. And then certainly the evening recommendation of THC to perhaps maybe not quite proven support sleep, which then can positively influence your chronic pain symptoms. So anyway, the take home point here is how we ended up with that CBD THC daytime evening. That was months of back and forth.
No, good. It's because, you know, when we read guidelines and recommendations afterwards, you're right. Sometimes it seems a little bit arbitrary. Well, why would they do this? But this was well thought out and well argued over. And like you said, when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think one of the key points is really that we are, if you're going to start with a daytime dose of anything, you're going to start with a CBD dose. And we actually provided and came up with an actual amount to recommend, which is between 5 and 20 milligrams of a CBD predominant product. Starting in the once a day, and then you can increase that as required once or twice a week. So it's important to the way that you increase it is something that a lot of physicians or nurse practitioners may not be familiar with, but it's not something that you would try it for one day, see what happens, and then increase or change the dose the next day. You've got to give it a few days in between each titration to see what your effects are, both positive and negative. And after getting up into a comfort level with the CBD dose, if you're going to consider introducing THC, we recommended that the starting dose of THC is a little bit lower, somewhere between 0.5 milligram up to 3 milligrams. Very cognizant of things like the person's age and their gender, older persons being a lot more sensitive typically to THC versus somebody who might be a non-naive user, perhaps has got some fair experience, might be able to manage a bit of a higher dose. And similar to CBD, the increases in 1 or 2 milligram increments once or twice a week. And we actually did reach a consensus on the maximum dose of THC. And this is something that we might, you might have listeners who disagree with us and who feel, gosh, no, I can handle much more than that. But this is really where you had 20-ish experts across a broad range, along with evidence that has been published and was incorporated, but we did reach a consensus on a maximum of THC between 30 and 40 milligrams. Now, I should also highlight that there is definite consensus that we are recommending oral extracts as the main means of using this, not smoked product, not vaporized or inhaled product, but using an oral product that is coming from a licensed producer that is easy to measure, so you know exactly what dose that you're using.
Thanks, Dr. O'Connell. I should be, like Aaron, I'm a pharmacist, so I was going to get to how we're getting it into the patient. So you're not talking about inhaled, whether smoked or vaporized. We're all talking oral, so we're talking either oils or capsules is pretty much what we're looking at.
So then the next step is in the tapering of the opioids. So I don't know if Aaron, you want to jump in on that, or Brennan?
Yeah, for sure. I want to add that when we talk about consensus here, it was the group, the threshold was 75% or higher. So just to define what consensus actually meant, and that the group would have to vote in that sort of domain. So the third domain, we looked at sort of questions about when and how to taper the opiates. When you look at the consensus finding, we basically discussed that depending on the patient, you know, beginning the opiate taper when any of the following criteria are basically achieved. So they've had an improvement in their pain and function. That's one. The cannabinoid dose, if it's being optimized or the patient begins to seek less as needed medication, that's another key consideration. And it was recommended to not begin tapering opiates at cannabinoid initiation or at a predefined or specific dose. That's key too. It's not just we're starting that process right off the bat. And I think it's not I think people do ask us in clinic about being a magic bullet and can I get off it tomorrow? The reality is we're not advocating for a rash decision-making here. I think it's really a methodical and as some of my colleagues have mentioned, there is some research into we know the opiate side of things for sure. So we're adding and layering it. Think of layering that sort of cannabinoid conversation. So when initiating the taper for the opiate, we were a gradual sort of dose reduction of 5 to 10% every 1 to 4 weeks was agreed upon of the minimal effective dose. So when you look at the timeline for the frequency of the reduction, it's meant to allow for sort of broad patient tailoring. So I think, when you look at this consensus, it's specific, but it's broad at the same time. So you can almost box your patient to some extent. And I think that we're not trying to be too prescriptive here. We're providing sort of keeping in mind general guidance that allows of each clinician that ultimately subscribes to this to tailor to who's in front of them and the unique circumstances their patient does present. And as I mentioned, there are opiate tapering guidelines out there. They don't provide any specific MED targets. And they encourage, again, that sort of individualized approach and a collaborative decision-making sort of process. So that's what we really based it on. And there are patients who could benefit from a 20 to 50% rapid taper after titrating to an effective dose, right? So once we're on a steady state of a cannabinoid dose, depending, of course, then on their objectives and their needs. So I think this particular domain as a part of the publication was allowing for a little bit more flexibility in terms of who you're plugging into the guidelines.
Yep. Thank you very much. Okay, so we figured out who we've got on it, who to enroll. We figured out how to taper them down. I guess the last part was how are we following them up afterwards? Anybody want to jump in on that one?
Sure, I can forego and tag team here, I guess. Just like any patient with chronic pain, and particularly patients who are on opioids, typically, particularly if you're following opioid guidelines, you'd be following them closely anyway. So when changes are being made, so through that initiation and titration, as well as the tapering, our consensus was that the patients are followed once or twice monthly until both pain control is stable and their dose is stable. And thereafter, it's following every 3 months. One of the things that we recommended and we talk about is ensuring that you have that goal that you're able to track, because that's going to be able to help you define your success and to be able to measure your progress against. So having that improvement in function or that improvement in quality of life is really important and helps you identify whether or not you're meeting your goals. In terms of just pain intensity, a clinical meaningful improvement on a pain scale of at 30% is usually what we consider to be a success. And certainly anything greater than 25% or more reduction in an opioid dose, we feel would be success. In Canada, we have what's called sort of your watchful dose of opioid level. And so, and a level of opioids through which we really would hope that most people can be kept below. And that's the equivalent of 90 milligrams of morphine per day. So just getting a patient under that ceiling would be considered successful, even if you're not entirely getting rid of an opioid. And so also any reduction in those opioid related harms would also be considered a success.
No, and that's a great thing to mention, because our College of Pharmacy, in conjunction with the Manitoba College of Physicians, is mandating is a little too strong, but strongly encouraging practitioners to get their patients under that magic 90 milligram morphine equivalents. And so, yeah, if this is yet another tool to get them there, I think that's a great idea. I want to just, because we're getting close on time, so just a few little bits. So sex differences. It looks like you guys at least discussed it a little bit during the consensus. Any thoughts on whether dosing should be different in males, females? Who wants to tackle that one?
I can make a quick comment, because it comes from Dr. LaFolle's work. He had published a nice placebo-controlled trial looking at the male-female interactions and difference. And I mean, the take-home point of his paper is at a given dose of THC, women do have a stronger, I guess, it has a stronger impact on females, basically. And then there was also another paper that looked at in females, the rate at which they might progress into some type of, call it a cannabis use disorder, was higher. And so you just, I think the take home point here is you just have to be maybe just a little bit more careful with females. Maybe Dr. O'Connell, you want to address that?
No, that's true. And the other thing that, it's also patients in terms of some of their comorbid conditions as well. So for instance, I work with a lot of individuals who have fairly complex neurologic conditions. And so sometimes we can find benefit with much lower doses, perhaps, than someone who might be working in an injured workers clinic, for instance, with so each individual really has to be taken as their own unique circumstances. And so their gender, their age, their comorbid conditions. And, our parameter is always start low, go slow. It's just how low is low might be different for each patient.
No, and that actually segues nicely into age. So in reading through the paper, it looked like everybody was pretty comfortable with CBD in kids, and that makes sense because we, you know, with Epidiolex and other things, it's now semi-official that we can use CBD in seizures in children. But it looks like there was a lot of discussion about whether or not to have a magic cutoff of age 25 for THC. Anybody want to talk a little bit about how you guys got to that?
Trevor, I just want to mention one thing just to the prior conversation here is the role of other medications when it comes to components like CBD. So there are real drug-drug interactions. It's metabolized by the liver, right? So if there's compromised liver function, as well as kind of you look at the 2D6 and 3D4 pathways, patients on a blood thinner or some other medications, from a safety lens, we certainly in clinic counsel them on what to monitor for in terms of adverse events. So just wanted to add that there as part of the conversation, I think, for some of your listeners who may be pharmacists. And you're right, there was consensus that no age restrictions per se were recommended for CBD or THC use. With CBD, we reached consensus as high doses of CBD have been shown to be safe in children. But with, as you mentioned, the patient population that's not necessarily typical as in a chronic pain sort of scenario, more to do with epilepsy. With regards to minimum age recommendations for THC, I think that there certainly should be guidance around, and being more, I guess, prudent around screening for patients under 25. And we usually do this in clinic because we know that there is a developing nervous system and there may be an impact in terms of the role of cannabinoids and THC specifically that might impact that. But if a young patient, let's say someone who's under 25, is already coming into the clinic who might be on a high dose of opiates, it didn't really make sense for them, for let's say, for us as the authors to say, okay, you know, you're not 25 yet. Therefore, you know, we're going to hold any sort of, you know, guidance around introducing cannabinoids as part of your therapy. So I think being sort of realistic and logical as to the patient that's presenting in front of you. But so I think at the end of the day, there's no minimum or really even a maximum age that was agreed to. When you look at sort of the elderly patient population, like we spoke about, I mean, reverse effects, especially the CNS depressant effects of sometimes cannabinoids with other medications they may be on. We're obviously worried about the risk of falls and so forth. So just being mindful of that as part of the treatment strategy is very important.
I promise that we try to get this done in under 40 minutes and we're getting close. So I thought this is sort of a good a time as any to, you know, any sort of final thoughts or thoughts where you think this will be going, anyone want to tackle, whether this is, might be good to, this could sort of leak over into the addiction sphere, anything along those lines. Like there's lots and lots left to talk about, but anyone sort of have any final thoughts on what we learned from this study and where we might be going next?
I can go first if you wanted, maybe Colleen, you can go at the end.
Yeah.
At least for me, from the research perspective, I'd love to see like a nice trial designed, you know, where you have patients on opioids and they're randomized to either a placebo or a THC or CBD or some combination of both, and basically apply this algorithm to see if it works. I think that's really because right now we have consensus guidance. We have, you know, a really nice document, a really nice way to go about it. But I think the next logical step is to test it.
Thank you very much. How about Aaron? Any sort of last words?
I'm looking at sort of again how this project how we started, and it was really driven by the lack of sort of a cohesive and sort of guiding document. This unmet need of how do I layer on sort of the current best practices when it comes to opiate initiation and tapering for chronic pain management and add in the cannabinoid conversation? I think that's where we started from. This came from sort of seeing what was going on the front lines with clinicians from all across the spectrum. And certainly there isn't a lens of sort of addictions management because we knew this was going on. I mean, in clinics across Canada and the United States. And it's about sort of getting a way to build something that I would liken to like a tree with tree branches and kind of having sort of this tree that's set up and the leaves will be filled over time. So it's a living document. It's something that I think will be added over time as we get more evidence that is hopefully randomized controlled trial evidence, as Brendan mentioned. But I think it's really a first step that is exciting and honestly has been driven from the unmet need that we identified. And as I mentioned, you know, I've worked in the downtown east side of Vancouver and you know, some of the things I've seen there with some of the patients who, you know, are potential candidates for you know, being enrolled in an algorithm like this. I think that initially we looked at sort of how do we create this expert guidance, and this is just the start. And I think for the viewers and those who are skeptics about sort of the lack of evidence, I think that from a lens of safety, keep that in mind, that we're not saying we've done an RCT here. We're looking at the practical guidance that's based on years of clinician experience that we've come up with. And again, it's just a start.
Thank you very much, Aaron. And Colleen, final word to you.
No, I was reiterate what Aaron just said, in that, you know, we are not claiming to be presenting a robust result of a randomized clinical trial. But I think in medicine and health, we still have a responsibility to try and optimize our patients' health, optimize their quality of life in a safe manner. And, you know, this would be the equivalent of walking down a hallway and trying to stop your local experts and ask them, hey, I've got this guy and here's the problem. What would you do in this situation? And here you have, you know, the benefit of a robust methodology to provide you with a consensus of experts' experience and opinion that is based on published evidence to inform that expertise. And this is a step to help towards guidance, and I think a very effective one, while we work towards gathering greater evidence, both of how this algorithm helps and future research insights as well.
That was fantastic. Thank you, everybody. Couldn't have asked for more. Coast to coast, we have people on here talking about a very interesting document, and people who all put up with my complete failure as a doodle poller. I'm getting better. I'll do better next time. But yes, thank you very much for everybody. Have a fantastic afternoon.
Thanks, Trevor.
Thanks, Trevor.
So, Kirk, one of the things that I like that they did touch on a little bit was sex differences. Now, I don't know if there's been any consensus really on exactly what the sex differences are between on effects of cannabinoids, but I'm glad they discussed it. And Brendan Smith talked about that a little bit. Anything else sort of jump out at you about things that they use to consider what they considered?
Not really. I mean, I was more interested in, I read the study and I'm looking at the results. I mean, the questions they asked is what patients can be considered for cannabinoid introduction. And I just think it's a real good pathway. And that's what they essentially said, that they're developing clinical guidelines through consensus, crowdsourcing of experts. So I thought it was just fantastic, because there's, you know, when one of the, you know, talking to Dr. Susie Pinnick, in episode 72, one of her big concerns when she first got into it was she didn't have anything to follow. So what these guys have done, this team of consensus building experts, is that they've provided clinicians a guideline in which to start, right? And it's consensus, and it meets current research and current application. So that's what jumped out on me. It's I'm looking forward.
My brilliant thought came back.
Okay,
Dr. O'Connell, Colleen O'Connell was talking about, sort of, she addressed kind of in passing, but I thought it was really interesting, is, well, why did they release this one? You know, opioids, reducing opioids with cannabis, you know, because this group are a very similar group, with like a lot of the same authors, did actually release one on just general, how do you dose cannabis for like pain? And she said, so why would we do opioids first before like a general how to dose and just pain? And it's because of the opioid crisis. Like, you know, we're hopefully now coming out of the COVID crisis, but there's still a lot of people out there dying of opioids and opioid overdose. So this group thought it was really important to do cannabis and opioids first, which, you know, I commend them for.
Well, right now, like I said to you in past episodes, there are more people dying of opioid overdoses in inner cities, and it's hidden again, right? It's so, yeah, this is another bullet in my belt that helps me argue, and it is arguing, it is debating hard about, let's look at cannabis to help people who are on opioids. Let's look at it. And another tool in the toolbox, right? So yeah, no, that's what jumped out on me. I think once again, I'm gonna recommend people come to our webpage. We'll have the paper up there and read it for yourself. And the physicians out there, the prescribers out there, have a look. It's well researched, and these guys have been dealing with cannabis for 20, 30 years, some of these people. So 20 years anyways. I exaggerated enough for 30 years.
No, I don't have a lot. I think I really appreciate that mentioned all their names again here at the end. So our guest this time was Aaron Saholta. He is the pharmacist from BC. Brendan Smith, he's the PhD. For this, it sounded like he was really kind of more the background, making sure the Delphi process thing worked right. I looked and his PhD is in physiology and metabolism. So it's interesting. He had a few cannabis papers assigned with his name. And then, you know, stuff on insulin and stuff he's giving to mice to see what happened to their glucose levels. So just interesting. It's got a bit of a range on what he does research on. And Colleen O'Connell, Dr. Colleen O'Connell, she is a physician out on the East Coast. So yeah, they had 20 people. We only had three, but it was that was quite the group. And thanks to all of them for agreeing to talk and share their knowledge with the listeners.
Yeah, yeah. So did any of them pick music?
No, they didn't pick music. So we might have to, unless you've got something on your mind, we might have to get Renee to pick something for us.
Desiree Dorian's got some new music out. Maybe we'll play some new Desiree Dorian. She's local.
Can't go wrong with can't go wrong with Desiree.
And she plays
she's got our theme song.
Let's do that. So I guess we should do our end of episode. I'm Kirk, I'm the nurse, and this is Reef for Madness, the podcast. And
I'm Trevor Schufeld, I'm the pharmacist.
And we are obviously eager for people to get onto our webpage. Check out the webpage. You can listen to the podcast, you can read the transcripts of each episode, and you can look at all the research that our experts are talking about. Very comprehensive. And if you're interested in supporting the podcast, you can drop us an email and we'll gladly accept assistance to move this post-epidemic podcast a little further up. And what else can we talk about?
I'm now king of doodle poll.
Yeah, you got some learning to do, I think. Yeah.
See you later, everybody.
Well, that's great, guys. Thank you very much. It's Renee here with two quick things. I should mention that Reefer Madness, the podcast, is recorded within unceded territory of Treaty 2 of the Anishinaabewakee. The other thing is, we do have a song by Desiree Dorian. She's got a new song. It's called Sometimes I Drink. We're very proud of her here and often, and here it comes.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next.
Sometimes I drink, get a buzzing in my brain. I don't want to complain, but I'm going insane.
Sometimes I like a glass of wine on Friday night at the Lonesome High. Forget about the bills and chill, forget about everything. It's been all uphill. I don't do this all the time, I just need this tonight. Well, I might get it wrong, but I'm just trying to get it right. I don't need anyone to buy me anything. I've been trying to do it all, but I'm not doing anything right. No, I don't do this all the time, but I just need this tonight. I don't do this all the time, I just need this tonight. Well, I might get it wrong, but I'm just trying to get it right. Yes, sometimes I drink, get a buzzing in my brain. I don't want to complain, but I'm going insane. I think I'm going to go ahead and pour just a little bit more, try to ignore it. Yes, sometimes I drink. Sometimes I drink. Yes,
So Kirk, one of the things you talked about before we had them was I've lost my train of thought. It was a really good thought. Really, really good. Gone.
Try Tim's new sweet chili chicken loaded wraps and bowls today. Take your taste buds on an exciting new adventure for lunch or dinner with our delicious new sweet chili sauce. It's time for sweet chili chicken. It's time for Tim's at participating restaurants in Canada for a limited time.